Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. President Biden has told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that any plans to send troops into the southern Gaza city of Rafah should not proceed without civilian considerations, the White House said on Sunday. Netanyahu earlier in the day on ABC's This Week signaled Israel plans to move forward with the military operation.
I think we've responded in a way that goes after the terrorists and tries to minimize the civilian population in which the terrorists embed themselves and use them as human shields.
The Senate is holding some procedural votes today on a bill that would provide aid to Israel as well as to Ukraine and Taiwan. Kickoff for Super Bowl 58 is just hours away, and as fans pack the stands, bets are rolling in, too.
According to the American Gaming Association, a record 67 million Americans are expected to bet on the big game.
ABC's Morgan Norwood. This is ABC News. Authorities are investigating the crash of a helicopter in Southern California's Mojave Desert on Friday.
The NTSB and FAA now investigating after the helicopter went down about 75 miles northeast of Barstow while flying from Palm Springs to Boulder City, Nevada, southeast of Las Vegas. Witnesses say there was rainy and wintry weather at the time, but it's not clear if that was the cause. Michael Graham with the NTSB.
This is the beginning of a long process. We will not jump to any conclusions.
All six on board, including the CEO of one of Nigeria's largest banks, were killed. Mark Remillard, ABC News.
It's the latest in a string of aircraft disasters in recent days. Last Tuesday, five Marines were killed when their helicopter went down east of San Diego. And on Friday afternoon, a small plane experiencing dual engine failure crashed into a Florida highway, killing two. The UK's King Charles III has made his first public appearance since being diagnosed with cancer earlier this month, attending church services earlier today. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
Getting your biggest tax refund from Jackson Hewitt can lead to some spirited reactions.
Jackson Hewitt, yeah!
Jackson Hewitt is so sure that you'll get your biggest refund that if they don't, you get your money back plus $100.
Jackson Hewitt, yeah!
And Jackson Hewitt also guarantees the accuracy of your return for life.
Hewitt, yeah!
So don't just sit there. For your biggest refund guaranteed, walk into a Jackson Hewitt today and dance out Jackson Hewitt, yeah!
Earl Ingram.
My special guest is the curator and founder of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society, none other than Claiborne Benson.
I want people to know that Wisconsin has a beautiful, rich African-American history. Many people think the King celebration and all of those other kinds of things are more important. They occurred in Wisconsin as well, and we've impacted the entire nation.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A lot of Wisconsin farms are handed down from one generation to the next, but many new farmers start their operations from scratch. As Mike Moan reports, many of them benefit from leasing their farmland.
More than a third of Wisconsin farmland is leased, that according to federal data. Kelly Wolfert is a farm management outreach specialist with the University of Wisconsin Extension. She suggests renting land is the only real option for new and emerging farmers. That's because current market conditions put owning property out of reach, and these individuals also have to invest in things such as new equipment, creating even bigger disadvantages.
Land is very expensive when you're competing against farmers who have assets already built up that they can leverage in order to afford that land.
Her team is trying to educate smaller operations about the dynamics of leasing agricultural property and what their rights are. Wilford says it's important to make sure you have your lease in writing with clear terms. She adds that being more vocal about conservation practices you might deploy could help get a break on the cost of the rent. Steve Okanek, a regional educator with UW Extension, says lacking social connections in a farming community you're eyeing for production is another barrier.
Especially if you're a new person coming into a neighborhood, it can be very difficult. It comes down to networking.
He says you should treat your quest for land almost like a job search, where establishing trust and familiarity might result in more leads. This outreach comes as the nation sees an influx of beginner farmers trying to get a bigger share of the market. In the most recent census of agriculture, there was a 17% increase in the number of farmers with less than 5 years of experience. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see partly sunny skies today and highs in the upper 30s with west winds of 5 to 10. Tonight, partly cloudy, mid-20s. On Monday, still a few clouds around with lower 40s in the afternoon and our winds turning to the northwest later in the day. Currently 35 degrees.
From the home of the frozen tundra, Green Bay's choice for news talk, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Weekday mornings from 8 till 10 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
Welcome to this, our second hour of our Saturday morning broadcast, talking all things Supreme Court and some other courts as well, but right now focusing a lot on what our United States Supreme Court entertained this past week in connection with the Colorado case. Strong prediction, an easy prediction, if you will, that they will hand Donald Trump, if you will, a win in connection with his attempt to remain on the Colorado ballot, obviously having an impact, as our callers indicated, on the future of this campaign in the next few months or so, and on other ballots around the nation, including Maine and other states. Another major event headed toward the Supreme Court, maybe or maybe not. Coming out of the D.C. Court of Appeals, we're going to spend some time in the first segments of this hour talking about this major case having to do with, yes, that's right, executive immunity. You know what this case is all about. The president maintaining, again, this is outside of the political process, but plainly having an impact upon it and impacting the campaign itself, that in connection with the criminal prosecution of him by Jack Smith, special counsel, Department of Justice, four counts alleging his involvement in an effort to undermine, to overthrow, to engage in interference in the 2020 election. Four counts, that case pending before Tanya Chutkan, in front of the district court there in the District of Columbia. She had previously written an omnibus order addressing all kinds of issues, saying that indeed Donald Trump does not have immunity. He is not immune from criminal prosecution. No one is above the law, she notably said, that we have presidents in this nation. We do not have kings. That case went up to the Court of Appeals, the D.C. Court of Appeals, the next highest court in that particular part of our nation. And indeed, just this past week on Tuesday, a couple of days before the oral argument in the Colorado case, down the street there, the D.C. Court of Appeals in another courthouse there in Washington, D.C., turns back and says, indeed, Donald Trump does not have presidential immunity. And without saying it out loud, says that the concept is absurd, that this is a near frivolous argument. Donald Trump on Wednesday being told by the Court of Appeals, a three-judge panel made up of three judges, including Karen Henderson, who is a Republican appointee, who has sided with Donald Trump on many other cases. All three of them unequivocally, unanimously say nothing to this notion of immunity by a president. Says this: we cannot accept former President Trump's claim that a president has unbounded authority to commit crimes that would neutralize the most fundamental check on executive power, the recognition and implementation of election results. That's what the three-judge panel wrote and released just this past week. We cannot accept that the office of the presidency places its former occupants above the law for all time thereafter. 57-page opinion, all three members of the panel coming to that conclusion. Obviously, a major decision by the Court of Appeals. It's been about a month putting that all together. And now along the way, the Court of Appeals, in addition to making those very important determinations, gives Donald Trump something of a deadline. Says if you want to appeal this, you need to go to the Supreme Court by Monday. Yes, that's this coming Monday. Basically appearing to acknowledge that he is going to be going in that direction, but discouraging him from asking the full appeals court to intervene, probably not going to be granted what's called an en banc hearing, all the judges of the D.C. Court of Appeals deciding this. And that, of course, would further drag out these proceedings. Along the way, the panel of the three judges says, for the purpose of this criminal case, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump. That language, again, much bandied about in the media these days, with all the defenses of any other criminal defendant. But any executive immunity that may have protected him while he served as president no longer protects him against this prosecution. Basically, the Court of Appeals saying, we're not deciding expressly, although certainly indicating very strongly that a president does not have immunity while in office. But today, Citizen Trump has no immunity whatsoever. Along the way, again, addressing a number of different issues, talking about this notion that somehow the separation of powers under that concept, the judicial branch lacks authority to review a president's use of executive power, this argument being made by Donald Trump. They reject that. They say former President Trump lacked any lawful discretionary authority to defy federal criminal law, and he is answerable in court for his conduct. Another affirmation of this notion that we have presidents, not kings. Second, Donald Trump had argued that there is a public interest for the presidents of our nation to be immune from prosecution. Society said better off if presidents don't have to be afraid of future charges, could chill their constitutional authorities and functions. The Court of Appeals say nope. Supreme Court has disallowed, they said, civil lawsuits against presidents over their official actions. But there are far greater limitations to bringing criminal charges. And they went on to say, so the risk that former presidents will be unduly harassed by meritless federal criminal prosecutions appears very slight. They made a reference to the fact that Gerald Ford had pardoned Richard Nixon after Watergate, all of that suggesting that there is the possibility of criminal prosecution long understood in the history of our nation. Former President Trump's alleged conduct, they said, conflicts with his constitutional mandate to enforce the laws governing the process of electing the new president, the three judges wrote. The criminal charges against him, they said, if proven true, amount to an unprecedented assault on the structure of our government, offering a little bit of insight into how they view the charges and the compelling nature of the charges pending against him right now. They went on to say this, that in response to Donald Trump's assertion that former presidents can't be prosecuted unless they're first impeached and convicted by the Congress. They said that's ridiculous. That's not at all a part of what our Constitution envisions. Repudiating that argument, saying the interpretation runs counter to the text, the structure, and the purpose of the impeachment judgment clause. The impeachment and criminal justice systems operate on separate tracks, they said, with separate purposes. And that interpretation implies that all civil officers, not just presidents, are immune from prosecution over official crimes unless they are first convicted in a Senate impeachment trial. That, they said, that notion is ridiculous. It would leave a president free to commit all manner of crimes with impunity so long as he is not impeached and convicted by the Congress, rejecting that outright. And finally, responding equally strongly to Donald Trump's contention that because he was acquitted in the Senate impeachment proceeding, that therefore it would be a violation of double jeopardy to have him prosecuted in Tanya Chutkan's court. Again, the Court of Appeals saying ridiculous, absurd, that the processes are unrelated. And while the charge the House brought against him, the incitement charge, was not among the charges a grand jury now indicted him on, getting into a little bit of the double jeopardy analysis. Judges also gestured to the political nature of the acquittal, noting that 30 senators had justified their votes to acquit him when this was in front of them on the grounds that his term in office had run out before the trial. And they said this, as a result of the political nature of impeachment proceedings, impeachment acquittals are often unrelated to, here we go, factual factual innocence. Impeachment acquittals are often unrelated to factual innocence. All of that from the Court of Appeals just this past week, an unequivocal statement rejecting Donald Trump's position on immunity. As I've said before, this is a frivolous argument. This is an argument that has no merit to it. It is regrettable that we are spending all of this time announcing that the sun rises in the east and not in the west. That's how absurd this proposition is. And yet, the district court obliged to address it, as she did. The Court of Appeals now saying the same thing in an equally broad and expansive opinion, providing a huge amount of support, addressing all the issues that Donald Trump raised and putting them all to bed. And so what is the big takeaway? What is the big takeaway from what happened this past week coming out of the D.C. Court of Appeals? It's just this. Once again, our theme this morning, our theme throughout this year is all about timing. Tick-tock. What's going on with the clock? Well, as I said, the Supreme Court plainly, as before it, this one case involving Colorado, it will decide that fairly soon, presumably before Super Tuesday. It's got another case we're going to talk about in just a minute or so involving Fisher. It's probably the most significant among the three, but it potentially, as soon as next week, could have this second case, this D.C. case before it as well. It depends upon what the Supreme Court does. Now, Donald Trump has signaled that he's going to meet the deadline established by the Court of Appeals, and yes, indeed, is going to appeal to the Supreme Court, this writ of certiorari, which we often talk about. And the Supreme Court then, effective Monday, close of business, will have a decision to make. Actually, can do one of two or three things. One is they can deny that writ. They can say, you know what, we're not going to be resolving this at all, as they do routinely. Right now, as of this morning, there are 60 cases on the docket of the Supreme Court. Hundreds more have been subject to a denial of writ. You don't get before the Supreme Court just by filing your papers. They could say, you know what? We're not going to review further this matter that the D.C. Circuit Court has addressed, the trial court has addressed. These omnibus opinions are clear. We don't need to say anything more about it. And indeed, I would offer that in a world, again, of perfect justice and perfect jurisprudence, that's what they should do. There's no conflict about this. Nothing here more to be said, aside from perhaps putting your imprimatur upon what the lower courts have already said. That is what they should do. Now, the question is, what will they do? That's a different question. And it's entirely possible that if you've got a majority of the Supreme Court justices who nonetheless want to be heard about this, they regard this maybe as their own version of Bush versus Gore. We talked about that before. Maybe their own version of the Colorado case. And they want to be heard about this and want to establish once again, as the Supreme Court has done before, that indeed presidents are not kings. No one is above the law. They can take this case and they can do one of two things, both of which would be telling about their particular animation. One is they could take the case and they could say that although we're going to take this on, we recognize that the entire prosecution in front of Judge Chutkan down the street in the district court has been suspended. She has taken this trial off her calendar. It's going to be requiring months of jury selection and of actual trial time. She's taken that off her calendar. The Supreme Court could very well say we need to get this expedited. And so while we're going to grant the writ, we're going to give you an expedited disposition of this. You file your brief within 5 days. Government, you respond to that within 5 days after that. We're going to schedule oral argument expeditiously as well. And we're going to resolve this very, very quickly. Even with that, we're probably talking about another month over and beyond Monday before the Supreme Court could enter an order, again, affirming almost certainly what the lower courts have said to this point. And there's a third option out there for the Supreme Court, which is perhaps the most disappointing, which we also need to put on the table this morning. And that has to do with putting this on the regular docket. That discussion about a regular docket is coming up next.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
Race to savings on your next project right now at Menards. Upgrade the floors in your home with new flooring from Tarkett. We carry durable laminate flooring, easy to install sheet vinyl, and waterproof vinyl plank. Tarkett Tidal Wave laminate flooring has a 30-year limited residential warranty and is the ideal choice for all homes. Get it today for just $229 a square foot at Menards. Price is good through February 18th. See store for details.
Save big money at Menards.
It's Fully Leaded Education Talk.
Busted Pencils with Dr. Tim and Dr. Johnny, weeknights at 7 on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 FM and 1590 AM WGBW, and on the Civic Media app. It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Kreutz.
Weekdays from 4 until 6
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Continuing our discussion this morning of all things Supreme Court, talking about the options before the Supreme Court, as it now has not yet on its docket, but playing the petition coming on Monday. Close of business Monday, Donald Trump and his attorneys will be filing this application for a writ of certiorari, seeking another level of review before the Supreme Court in a case that, again, has clarity in its ultimate disposition. There is no question but for the fact that the lower court, the district court, the appeals court have gotten this right. Presidents do not have immunity. And if indeed any court in this land, including the Supreme Court, should find otherwise, that is the beginning of the end of the republic, because, as many people have said, then we're restoring the monarchy. Then we do, in fact, have a presidency that is without checks and balances. If a president can do whatever he or she wants to do, we have then returned to a pre-1776 period in our nation's history. Can't do it. Not a possibility. So the result here, once again, just like right now, the Colorado case is resolved effectively. We haven't seen the paper on that yet. This case is also not subject to reasonable disagreement here. Everybody of a reasonable nature acknowledges that there is no presidential immunity. And what is going on here, of course, is a delay in the trial in front of Judge Chutkan. And that's why what the Supreme Court does next, presumably as soon as next week, is all telling about their particular animation as they work indeed in the midst of a campaign in 2024. As I said right before our discussion, suspended here for just a moment, before the Supreme Court decides what it's got to do, it can turn back this appeal, can deny the request outright, in which case Tanya Chutkan, the day after they deny that grant, that writ of certiorari, she can call the parties in and put this thing back on her calendar. She can find the trial time to do it. It's a lot of time, but she can get them back in, have a status conference, a pretrial conference, and get this back on her calendar the moment the Supreme Court denies Donald Trump's application. More likely, potentially, the Supreme Court says, well, we'd like to weigh in on this. It is a matter of national importance, and I suppose it is, but for the fact that the issue is preordained. We know what the result has to be here, and so it is frustrating, I think, for an awful lot of us out here who think about the legitimacy of the process, to think that the Supreme Court now needs to weigh in. And yes, we understand the Supreme Court wants to articulate once again, hopefully, what would be a unanimous position, that there is not a presidency that is in the nature of a kingdom, a situation where we've returned to the monarchy in our nation. If the Supreme Court does that, they could put this on a very expedited schedule. Even that, however, taking probably days, weeks, presumably postponing the ultimate rescheduling of this matter in front of Judge Chutkan by about a month. And every single month, of course, in this calendar year takes up more time, delays the time when Judge Chutkan can begin to impanel a jury. That will itself take a number of weeks right there in the District of Columbia. Presumably, the presentation by the special counsel is going to take weeks. Donald Trump does not have to present any defense, but presumably would. And that could also take days, if not weeks, before a jury then gets the case to deliberate on, presumably months down the road. And that, of course, begins only after this issue of immunity, this frivolous issue of immunity, is resolved ultimately by a court. Supreme Court could do it quite literally hours after the petition for writ of certiorari is filed on Monday. Will they do that? We will see. If in fact they put this on what is the regular docket and they accept certiorari, just as they have with all of the other 60 cases as of this morning on the docket of the Supreme Court, if they do that, they could also establish a routine briefing schedule. If they do that, they have signaled their own sense of urgency, which is very little in that particular circumstance, because there you've got weeks before petitioners file briefs, you've got responsive briefs, you've got reply briefs, all these kinds of things. There will probably be amicus briefs filed by various parties around the country. All of that, as in all these other cases, takes time. And then if indeed we get a decision along with all the other cases we've talked about on this broadcast in the areas of social media and about guns and about all the other things that we have discussed along the way in our broadcast to this point last year and this year, if that is on the regular docket, the regular schedule that does not contemplate an expedited resolution along the way, then we can anticipate a decision in June, maybe May, but in June. And at that point, you have profoundly, profoundly affected the trial calendar. At that point, Judge Shutkin may have great difficulty in finding a time on her very busy docket. Remember, this is not the only case that she and her colleagues at the district court, the trial court level, have on their dockets. Then it is entirely possible that there will be no trial before the November election, or if there is, it will be just on the heels of that significant event happening. TikTok, time once again, an animating feature of 2024. And in all of these, the interplay between the litigation, the criminal prosecution, the civil cases we've talked about as well, and the pendency of things like Super Tuesday, the people going to the polls here in the state of Wisconsin and in other places around the country, Colorado, all the other states, primary elections coming up, all those kinds of things. A convention coming up in Milwaukee for the Republicans in July, for the Democrats in Chicago right after that in August, and then the final weeks into the election. All of these kinds of things animated by time in and out of our federal courts, criminal courts, and civil courts as well. Look next week to see what the Supreme Court does. They're not obliged. They're not on a particular schedule to decide whether to grant this writ of certiorari or not. But they need to do it. They need to tell the American public what they are doing and with what level of speed are they going to address this. They can take care of it very quickly, or they can, at the other extreme, put this on the regular docket and schedule this, presumably for the announcement of an opinion, the substance of which we all know, and that is that there is no immunity and that presidents are not kings, as Tanya Chutkin has said. That's the second case. And again, the reality is that as much as Donald Trump may be granted a win on the Colorado matter, he will be granted ultimately a loss on this issue related to immunity. There is no there there. There's nothing to see here. The question is, when will the Supreme Court issue that opinion? And then, as we have talked before, there is yet a third case that does not have Donald Trump's name on it. But I would offer, as I have before, that this case involving Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R, Joseph Fisher is his name, is among the three, the ones that's the least clear in terms of his disposition, and arguably because it's least clear, also has the most profound effect potentially upon that criminal case being prosecuted right now by Jack Smith and special counsel in front of Tanya Chutkin in the D.C. Circuit. Why? Because of what Joseph Fisher is, what he has petitioned for, what he has done. The man who brings that appeal, again, his name, Joseph Fisher, has said that the law was applied against him incorrectly and that the charges against him have to be overturned by the Supreme Court. On recent days, in mid-December or so, this particular matter was granted cert by the Supreme Court. And the discussion continues this morning about what the content of that appeal is all about, why it is significant for hundreds of people already charged and convicted for the assault on our Capitol, and yes, indeed, why it is so critically important for understanding what Tanya Chutkin will and will not have in front of her when that case ultimately goes to trial, the criminal trial in her court against Donald Trump.
Mino and the Mayor in the morning.
And the talk of Green Bay all day long.
1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Mike Dubusky. President Biden has told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that any plans to send troops into the southern Gaza city of Rafah should not proceed without civilian considerations, the White House said on Sunday. Netanyahu earlier in the day on ABC's This Week signaled Israel plans to move forward with the military operation.
I think we've responded in a way that goes after the terrorists and tries to minimize the civilian population in which the terrorists embed themselves and use them as human shields.
The Senate is holding some procedural votes today on a bill that would provide aid to Israel as well as to Ukraine and Taiwan. Kickoff for Super Bowl 58 is just hours away, and as fans pack the stands, bets are rolling in, too.
According to the American Gaming Association, a record 67 million Americans are expected to bet on the big game, whether casually with friends, part of a pool, or traditional wagers online.
ABC's Morgan Norwood. This is ABC News.
Marquette gets a win at home. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Number 7th-ranked Marquette defeated St. John's 86-75. Head coach Shaka Smart.
Happy National Marquette Day, everybody. That was a terrific second-half effort by our entire group. I thought St. John's came in here with great desperation. Anytime you beat a team by one the last time and they have a shot at the buzzer to win it, they're going to feel some kind of way about that.
The Golden Eagles have now won 7 in a row. The number 11th-ranked Badgers suffering a stunning loss at Rutgers, 78-56. 22 points, the biggest win over a ranked team in Rutgers basketball history. Wisconsin has now lost 4 in a row. I'm in Las Vegas covering Super Bowl 58, where Jordan Love did some interviews, and I asked him about the slump the Packers went through.
Yeah, it was a tough stretch we had. We went on a 4-game losing streak, but I'm proud of everybody for being able to turn around.
That's Packers quarterback Jordan Love. From Super Bowl 58 in Las Vegas, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your Fox Valley forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For tonight, mostly clear skies. We'll see a low around 25 degrees, mostly sunny on Monday and a high near 42. For Monday night, mostly clear, lows in the mid-20s again. For Tuesday, mostly sunny, a high near 36. Wednesday, partly sunny, 41.
Right now, 35.
Valentine's Day is here. This year, give the ultimate gift. Name a star after your sweetheart. This is Rocky Moselle with International Star Registry. For 45 years, we've named millions of stars for celebrities, dignitaries, and individuals worldwide. For $59 and a call to 800-282-3333 or visit starregistry.com, you can give the most memorable gift. The star you name will be recorded in book form in the U.S. Copyright Office. Visit starregistry.com or call 800-282-3333.
Hi, I'm Pete Schwabe, an actor, writer, director, and comedian. Join me for my new show, Nightlight, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll chill after a long day in traffic, talking politics, or trying to look busy at work. We'll talk movies, TV, theater, music, and lots of fun Wisconsin stuff. So mix an old-fashioned and join the discussion. We'll go from Wisconsin to Hollywood and back, and you can still be in bed by 10. It's Nightlight with Pete Schwabe, weeknights from 8 to 10, on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 FM, WGBW.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s. Time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black history story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
Broadcasting from the City Deck Studios on North Washington Street, the Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We are talking this morning in these final segments of our two-hour broadcast about Supreme Court cases. Another case, a third case, not often discussed in the national media, not the subject of a lot of attention out there, called United States versus Fisher. United States versus Fisher. Back in December, mid-December, the justices of the Supreme Court granted a writ of certiorari, said, yes, indeed, we're going to take this case on. It decided to review the charge of obstruction of an official proceeding that was brought against Mr. Fisher. Mr. Fisher, among the thousands of people there on Capitol Hill that day, among the 1,200 or so who've been the subject of investigations and charges and convictions and sentencings, including among them Joseph Fisher. Joseph Fisher, again, charged with this particular statute in the federal criminal code, a charge of obstruction of an official proceeding. Significantly, 300 people altogether been charged with this particular statute for those crimes allegedly committed during the Capitol riot. And the reason why this is so significant is because former President Trump, in that case pending right now in front of Tanya Chutkan, we've talked so much about this morning and in previous broadcasts, Donald Trump is also charged under this same statute in two of the four counts against him in the indictment there. And that is of significance, even as that matter proceeds ultimately to trial once this issue related to immunity is finally resolved, hopefully sooner rather than later, by the United States Supreme Court. Joseph Fisher says, of course, the law has been applied incorrectly against people who are charged over their involvement in the riot. And federal prosecutors, of course, come back against that and say, no, Mr. Fisher was one of thousands who participated in that attack. And the charge that we have brought against him, that is this obstruction charge, is precisely right. Mr. Fisher says no. He says that the law, which was in fact created, he's right about this, in the wake of an accounting scandal in 2002, initially enacted by Congress to prevent corporate malfeasance during trials, he says that government prosecutors and people in the U.S. Attorney's Office, Department of Justice generally, have been unreasonably stretching this particular statute to cover, to apply to these charges against him and about 300 other people. The lawyers for Mr. Fisher, who've been defending him in the lower court, in the circuit court, and now the Supreme Court, said specifically that those who stormed the Capitol on January 6th were not acting corruptly. That's the important language from this particular statute. That's what the law commands, the demands under this particular statute. They said the rioters were protesting what they honestly believed to be a stolen election, not acting corruptly. Justice Department, of course, pushes back strongly against that, has argued that the official proceeding could refer to a proceeding of Congress, and indeed that all the terms and conditions, all the elements of proof are there with respect to this prosecution against Mr. Fisher and about 300 other people also charged under this same count. This same statute. The Supreme Court decision to hear the matter then is significant not only for Mr. Fisher and, frankly, huge numbers of people already charged under that particular statute, but also for, yes, that's right, criminal defendant Donald Trump now facing prosecution on that indictment against him in Tanya Chutkan's courtroom. We know well that the special counsel charged Donald Trump with obstruction of an official proceeding, along with three other federal crimes. They used that particular statute. Donald Trump, we hasten always to add, has pleaded not guilty. He is entitled to the presumption of innocence and is entitled, if he cares to, not obliged to present evidence in defense of those charges against him. That's what a trial is all about. That's the due process in our nation about which he complains. Instead, he says, I'm a victim of political witch hunt. As we've talked previously, nothing of the case. The attorneys for Mr. Fisher in this collateral but very much related case noted the connection between their petition with respect to their client and Donald Trump. He said the case presents an important question of federal law affecting hundreds of prosecutions arising from January 6th, including the prosecution of former President Donald Trump. And here's the rub. Here's the reason why this is so significant. When Joseph Fisher first presented this to the lower court, again, one of Tanya Chutkan's colleagues, the trial court in the D.C. court, the D.C. trial court there, the district court actually ruled in favor of Mr. Fisher and found that, indeed, the government was wrong
and that the attorneys for Mr. Fisher are right, that this particular statute does not apply to him, and therefore entered an order that basically would have reversed the judgment against him because it was improperly charged. Interestingly, the wake of that goes up where? To the D.C. Court of Appeals, the same kind of process we talked about before in connection with the matter related to immunity. And the D.C. Court of Appeals, a three-judge panel there, decides not unanimously, but by 2-1 to overturn, to reverse the lower court ruling and basically say, yes, the government wins. The government has, in fact, properly charged this particular case against Mr. Fisher under this statute and reverses the trial court decision. And it is that appellate court decision coming out of the D.C. Court of Appeals that is now before the Supreme Court. That's the decision that the Supreme Court has granted certiorari on, and that's the opinion, that's the judgment that is now up for their review by all justices of the Supreme Court. And as indicated by the differences in opinions by reasonable people, the appellate court, the lower court, this is one where reasonable justices, reasonable lawyers, reasonable people, non-lawyers, can disagree, as we often say. Mr. Fisher asking the Supreme Court to basically endorse what the trial court had said, to reverse what the appeals court had said. And indeed, there are arguments on both sides. It is not unusual, candidly, for the Supreme Court during the course of my time, my 30 years with the U.S. Department of Justice as a criminal prosecutor and also civil litigator, including some years as the United States Attorney, some years in Washington, D.C., some years overseas in another district in this nation. All during that time, the Supreme Court has from time to time taken statutes and said, you know what? The government has not been properly applying them. I think especially about the mail fraud statute, having to do with the possibility of prosecuting public officials for the deprivation of honest services. It's a broad and important discussion having to do with the interpretation of federal law. The Supreme Court overturned the commonplace application of a particular statute and said overnight, and changed overnight, the disposition of cases pending in the federal trial courts and the appellate courts. Supreme Court can, in fact, interpret this particular statute that Mr. Fisher is challenging to say that, you know what, the government got it wrong. They could also say the government got it right, in which case Mr. Fisher's judgment and that of the 300 other people remains in place. Those convictions go forward. The terms of imprisonment, to the extent that those sentences have been imposed, those go forward. And those cases get closed. And then, significantly, Jack Smith, in his prosecution against Donald Trump, after the Supreme Court resolves this immunity issue, can go ahead with all four counts of the indictment against him, depending upon what the Supreme Court says. Supreme Court could make some decisions that parse the language somewhat and determines that, in fact, it is applicable here and not there. We'll have to wait to see exactly what they do. And that's the final point in the Fisher matter. Again, having to do with timing. As of this morning, February 10th of 2024, the Supreme Court still has not granted a date for oral argument on Fisher. It's got a docket now through the end of March. Its March setting is chock full of cases. We talked about some of those last broadcast. To this date, to this morning, the Supreme Court has not put Fisher on its docket for oral argument like it has, presumably has, in these other cases. And what that means is that this case may not be heard until April, maybe even May. At that point, it gets very, very late in the season. We certainly would anticipate that the Supreme Court will decide Fisher by June. But if indeed the timing on this is such that the Supreme Court, hopefully, would embrace the notion advanced by the government, that certainly is my bias, but again, my reading of the statute, my application of it, my understanding of how Jack Smith is using it to the particular facts against not only the Fishers of the world, but yes, also Donald Trump in that indictment. We talked about that indictment at great length in prior broadcasts. Strikes me as a former prosecutor that its application here, although not routine, is appropriate. And the Supreme Court should indeed embrace that application as it has in other cases. If, in fact, it doesn't do that and basically stops the judgments and the convictions from going ahead with respect to Mr. Fisher, it presumably would also have an impact upon the trial in front of Judge Chutkan, wherever that may be in April or May and June. And once again, underscoring this common theme that I continue to repeat, which is timing, and how all of these decisions will have an interplay into the very trials that are being affected by decisions of higher courts. If Mr. Fisher is successful, the prosecution by Jack Smith against Donald Trump potentially could be cut in half or significantly changed. The government can always go back and supersede, return a new indictment. But again, getting very late in the day, again, in the midst of an election year, as Donald Trump presumably is collecting primary victories along the way, as the current president, Joe Biden, is also collecting his primary victories, heading toward nomination in July and August, heading toward an almost certain battle between Donald Trump and Joe Biden in November. Depending upon how the courts decide all these cases, and today I'm not making any specific prediction about Fisher, I believe that there's a strong, strong argument to be made that the government is right about this. And I anticipate the Supreme Court, at least a majority of them, will embrace that. Probably won't be a majority opinion, but a majority of them will embrace that. Depending upon when they decide that case, however, once again, could have an impact upon the conduct, the timing of the trial, the timing of a presumed possible conviction by a jury based upon the evidence presented. The government, once again, obliged to present evidence beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury, has to decide it unanimously. All that's got to happen before there could be a finding of conviction, a finding of criminal liability, before the assumption of innocence, the presumption of innocence, no longer applies. Lots and lots of things going on. A win for Donald Trump, almost certainly with respect to Colorado. A loss for him coming up with respect to immunity. The question there is, when does that happen? And then presumably a loss for him as well when it comes to this Fisher case, but not nearly as certain. And the timing on that, probably of the three, the least certain of all. I should note as a footnote to that, that among the other cases that we will also discuss in future broadcasts, on the same day that the court of the United States Supreme Court granted this writ of certiorari in the Fisher matter, they also granted the writ of certiorari reviewing the decision that you may recall well coming out of Texas and the Fifth Circuit. This decision made by Matthew Kaczmarek, a district court judge in Texas, finding, banning the distribution of mifepristone, which is this commonly used abortion pill, and determining that the FDA had improperly authorized its use by medical officials, by doctors, and by other medical staff around the country. A shocking decision. Recently also further undermined by revelations that the very laws and the very findings that he came to premised upon some official findings, if you will, some science that's determined to be junk science. Just this past week on that particular case, the decision that Judge Kaczmarek came to premised upon his view that mifepristone is in fact dangerous, is not in fact the safe and secure drug that the FDA has said it is. Just this past week, the authorities, who are, I think, called Sage Publications, announced it was retracting three of those articles that helped form the basis for Judge Kaczmarek's conclusion that access to this drug, mifepristone, should be restricted. Now, that's somewhat of a sideshow to the appellate issue, which went up to the Court of Appeals and is now before the Supreme Court. And they also will be entertaining argument on whether or not mifepristone remains an accessible medical procedure, a medical pharmaceutical for abortion practices in America. That also coming up. They granted that writ on the same day, that they granted the writ in the Fisher case, which we will talk about as well, as those cases are decided down the road. Lots and lots of things pending before the United States Supreme Court. More to talk about this morning on our broadcast, including some commentary related to the prosecution in Georgia and the recent decision by the special counsel reviewing the Joe Biden documents case not to prosecute. All of that coming up next.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Arnold Show.
Getting your biggest tax refund from Jackson Hewitt can lead to some spirited reactions.
Jackson, you yeah!
Jackson Hewitt is so sure that you'll get your biggest refund that if they don't, you get your money back plus $100.
Jackson Hewitt! Yeah!
And Jackson Hewitt also guarantees the accuracy of your return for life. So don't just sit there. For your biggest refund guaranteed, walk into a Jackson Hewitt today and dance out Jackson Hewitt, yeah!
Earl Ingram.
Sandy, people are talking about influencers. I don't see too many septuagenarians or octogenarian influencers. They're alive.
We're trying. Radio shows like this are efforts to be influencers, I suppose. Yeah. I mean,
we can possibly be influencers?
Well, maybe. I don't know.
Calvin's laughing.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Media.us.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
Our website, civicmedia.us.
This is our final segment of our Saturday morning broadcast, talking about three more cases that animate what's going on in our federal courts. We spoke before about Eileen Cannon right now presiding over this unrelated but somewhat associated trial having to do with the Mar-a-Lago documents. Just this past week, making some significant decisions about witness security. We know from recent reporting the federal authorities right now are investigating a series of threats made online to potential witnesses related to this Jack Smith prosecution of the classified document case. And that had prompted Jack Smith to seek the disclosure to the court and to the litigation generally of information relevant to that prosecution, but not in the public domain, ensuring that Donald Trump and other people do not have the opportunity to provide information about these matters that are security related, that have to do with the integrity of the process, and that expose potential witnesses to threats of harm. This past week, Jack Smith is asking Eileen Cannon to reverse a recent decision that could expose potential witnesses in that case to threats from the very thing that these investigators are looking at right now. Special counsel filed a motion to reconsider that ruling, which they considered a clear error that defied 11th Circuit Court of Appeals precedent, and that would publicly release discovery documents in unredacted form at the request of the former president and some media groups. Again, Jack Smith trying to protect the integrity of the process and the witnesses there. Special counsel's office pleading with Cannon to reverse that recent unsealing decision, which would disclose this information about those witnesses that would identify 24 of them and expose them to threats. And in particular, the special counsel saying the discovery material, if publicly docketed in unredacted form, would disclose the identities of numerous potential witnesses, along with the substance of the statements they made to the FBI or the grand jury, exposing them to significant and immediate risks of threats, intimidation, and harassments, as has already happened to witnesses, law enforcement agents, judicial officers, and Department of Justice employees whose identities have been disclosed in cases in which defendant Trump is involved. Now, why is this significant? Well, it has to do once again with Eileen Cannon and the 11th Circuit. Smith, in particular, arguing that the judge incorrectly stated that the government must show a compelling interest in keeping the documents private. That is not the standard. That isn't the standard that's used by trial court judges. And Jack Smith, of course, adopting that and saying the standard does not apply to documents filed to satisfy discovery requirements, saying just this: the 11th Circuit has held that the compelling interest standard applied by Eileen Cannon does not apply to documents filed in connection with motions to compel discovery, which instead may be sealed or redacted simply upon showing of good cause. Because the court applied the wrong legal standard, reconsideration is warranted to correct clear error. Now, what does that all mean? That means that Jack Smith is giving Eileen Cannon another opportunity to go back and get it right this time. She has applied the wrong standard. And he has said, before we take this up to the Court of Appeals, before we go back to the 11th Circuit, we'll give you the chance to remedy the error that you have made. Now, unlikely,
unlikely that Eileen Cannon will do that, in which case, predictably, because of the seriousness of this, we've got people's lives who are at stake, threats made against witnesses and other officials. Highly likely that Jack Smith will take this up to the 11th Circuit. Have we seen this show before? The answer is yes, we have. You may recall well that in the wake of the search of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence, Eileen Cannon entertained for months a challenge to the investigation, pre-charging before any charges were returned, ultimately taken up to the 11th Circuit. And you may recall well, the 11th Circuit sends this compelling order back to Eileen Cannon saying, you've got it wrong. The trial courts have no business involved in these kinds of investigative matters. You've got no capacity to oversee this investigation. Do you have responsibilities when it comes to executing search warrants and doing other things, applications for discovery during the investigation, but not oversight in a civil setting of the pendency of a criminal investigation like this one? 11th Circuit sending that back with a firebrand on top of the order saying, dismiss this case, which you have entertained, Eileen Cannon. You've gotten it wrong. Jack Smith now probably will take this up again, and we may see a repeat of what happened before. And at some point beyond this, also, Jack Smith may well finally file the application for recusal, for substitution of a judge, because of the record of, let's call it hostility, that he is beginning to amass in this case. We know as well that she has made various orders, delayed certain proceedings having to do with the legitimacy of certain national security matters, how that is processed, all those things being delayed. Jack Smith has a list now of things that Eileen Cannon has done, both in terms of delays and now affecting the future of witness presentations that go right to the core of this criminal prosecution. And in addition to going up to the Court of Appeals, where he presumably will get the Court of Appeals to embrace the proper standard, and the Court of Appeals will presumably send this back to her and say, you've got to apply the proper standard. You've got to reverse your previous order. All of that, once again, taking, here we go, time, right? Tick-tock, once again. But even if that happens, Jack Smith at some point needs to consider, as I'm certain he is, inside the halls of justice there in Washington, D.C., a potential petition to have her recused based upon the conduct in which he's engaged on the bench, admittedly in her official capacity, that can indeed affect the legitimacy. This is a big one, having to do with whether or not the disclosure of names, identities of witnesses that we know have been the subject of threats and concerns about the future of their presentations in trial, that nothing short of that is at stake in this matter. It's a huge issue. It's a huge issue. And finally, just a couple of very brief comments. One is with respect to the Joe Biden release from the special counsel, finding that indeed he should not be prosecuted because indeed there's no willfulness. I want to say that I concur with my former boss, Eric Holder, who said that the comments about the status, the condition, the temperament, if you will, the intellectual capacity of the present president during the course of his interview, completely inconsistent with internal Department of Justice processes and language. And when I was in the Department of Justice, that kind of thing would be reviewed and would be excised because it's not relevant to the core finding, which is about willfulness, which is what that report said. And the extraneous language about the president, it's not just a political comment. It's not a political comment at all. It's not properly there. It's not properly there. And it is unfortunate that in the midst of this otherwise legitimate review and exercise of investigative prerogative by the special counsel there, that the determination, a proper determination of no criminal prosecution based upon a lack of willfulness, is joined with this harassing and inappropriate comments about one of the witnesses, the target, the subject of that investigation. More of this kind of discussion in all of our Saturday morning broadcasts coming up. I invite you back to our table in the future discussions of the...
Your home for the Devil's Advocates, weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM, WGBW. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Getting your biggest tax refund from Jackson Hewitt can lead to some spirited reactions.
Jackson Hewitt!
Jackson Hewitt is so sure that you'll get your biggest refund that if they don't, you get your money back plus $100.
Jackson!
Jackson Hewitt.
And Jackson Hewitt also guarantees the accuracy of your return for life. So don't just sit there. For your biggest refund guaranteed, walk into a Jackson Hewitt today and dance out Jackson Hewitt. Yeah.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Mike DeBusk.